Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
The fact is, we are at the fiscal cliff that has been foretold for at least the last 10 years.
The state Senate moves forward a new version of the governor's tax bill. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, February 24th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, the Army Corps of Engineers backs out of tapping a lake as a solution for Juneau's glacial outburst floods.
This community needs to be very singularly focused and together on what we need and demand for the survival of our community.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
The PFD application is open. Just a small amount of your PFD will help share local news and stories about Alaskans with Alaskans across this great state when you choose Alaska Public Media through Pick, Click, Give.
Alaska senators moved forward a new version of Governor Mike Dunleavy's tax bill last week. It bears little resemblance to the bill the governor proposed earlier this year as part of his broader fiscal plan. The Senate Resources Committee's version strips out the governor's sales tax proposal, which received fierce criticism from legislators, local leaders, and the public. It also dispenses with the governor's proposal to end corporate income taxes in the early 2030s. And it adds a $20 to $60 yearly income tax to support public education. Anchorage Republican Senator Kathy Geisel, who chairs the committee, says the state badly needs the revenue to pay for the services that Alaskans expect.
The fact is, we are at the fiscal cliff that has been foretold for at least the last 10 years. I mean, we're not just at it anymore. We are falling over it.
The biggest change to the bill is a major shift to the way the state would calculate oil taxes. Instead of taxing net profits, the state would base its tax on the gross value of the oil itself. Anchorage Democratic Senator Bill Willikowski proposed the oil tax change, and he says it's an approach that has worked well in oil-rich states like Texas and North Dakota. He says alongside the state's royalty, it would mean Alaska would take about a third of the value of each barrel of oil.
The reality is, if we're getting a combined gross of right now 16% roughly, and every other state is getting close to 30%, I don't think we're maximizing the value of our oil as we're required to under the Constitution.
The new Senate version also drops some must-haves from Governor Dunleavy's fiscal plan. Dunleavy's tax plan was linked to limits on state spending and a constitutionally guaranteed permanent fund dividend. But with senior senators skeptical of those limits, the new version of the tax plan would stand alone. Fairbanks Senator Rob Myers, a minority Republican, says that means the bill no longer addresses the issues the governor's fiscal plan was intended to solve. That is, making the state's budget more stable and less vulnerable to wild swings in oil prices.
In my personal opinion, oil money and the patterns that it creates is what got us into this mess. And without a full fiscal plan, simply increasing oil taxes and a little bit of corporate tax, to me, is the financial equivalent of trying to cure a hangover with a shot of vodka. We're going the wrong direction here.
Bipartisan majority members passed the bill out of the Senate Resources Committee on a 5-2 vote on Wednesday, with the two minority Republicans opposed. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has backed out of studying a lake tap solution to the glacial outburst floods that have ravaged Juneau's Mendenhall Valley neighborhoods in recent years. City officials say the Corps' abrupt change in position comes as a shock and could derail the city's timeline to get a long-term solution in place, especially as new data shows future floods could be far worse. KTOO's Clarice Larson reports.
Juneau City Manager Katie Kester shared the news at a Juneau Assembly Committee of the Whole meeting Monday night. She called the Army Corps' change of position to study a lake tap solution deeply frustrating.
So it was a really disheartening pivot that left us a little bit speechless, and I imagine also leaves you speechless.
The Army Corps has played a critical role in finding short and long-term solutions as the capital city faced catastrophic annual glacial outburst flooding that damaged hundreds of properties and threatened residents' safety in recent years. Late last year, the agency held a 3-day closed-door meeting with federal and local agencies in Juneau, where they discussed 5 long-term options to prevent homes from flooding and ultimately picked one. The solution they landed on was to construct a lake tap, which is basically a tunnel through a mountain by the glacier that would steadily drain Suicide Basin so it doesn't burst. Shortly after the Army Corps announced its recommendation, city leaders, along with the U.S. Forest Service and the Central Council of the Klinkin-Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska, all announced their support for pursuing the solution. But Kester said that plan is in limbo following a meeting with the agency last week.
They rescinded all of the direction that they'd previously given to pursue a lake tap as the selected alternative, and basically said that they would continue to support flood fighting in the area for an undetermined amount of time.
Kester said she's still trying to piece together the why behind the Corps' actions and how it will impact developing a long-term solution.
We don't know. We don't understand why this change. Certainly the price tag is sobering. Also, we don't have a lot of information.
The lake tap was estimated to cost $613 million to complete. Kester asked residents to reach out to Alaska's congressional delegation to advocate for moving forward with the lake tap solution.
This community needs to be very singularly focused and together on what we need and demand for the survival of our community.
Kester's news came shortly after city engineers gave a presentation that shared more information about what they say is a sobering outlook for what could be in store in a worst-case scenario for future floods.
It is massive.
That's Denise Koch, the city's director of engineering and public works. Over the past 3 years, glacial outburst flooding has crested between 15 and 16.65 feet in the Mendenhall River. Last year, a temporary levee made of HESCO barriers protected hundreds of homes by a slim margin. The city does not know how the levee will perform if flood levels exceed 18 feet. Koch said new worst-case scenario data shows water peaking at 22.5 feet, with 118,000 cubic feet per second of water.
2,855 properties, that's the magnitude of what could be impacted by that worst-case scenario, Glof. It's hard to almost get your head around how many properties we're talking about impacting.
Koch said a worst-case flood would submerge most of the Mendenhall Valley if there isn't a way to stop the water.
We're talking about water crossing over Riverside Drive, moving east into the valley, crossing over Mendenhall Loop Road, getting into the Dredge Lakes area, also having impacts on the western side of the river, impacting the Mendenhall Wastewater Treatment Plant, having impacts to the airport.
Koch said the flood tap solution is the best solution to protect residents and properties in the Mendenhall Valley in the long term.
And the reasons that went into that being the preferred alternative is it has a very high likelihood of reducing that GLOF risk.
City officials say the Army Corps will still pay for the installation of a second phase of HESCO barriers ahead of this year's expected flood. Kester said she will be meeting with the agency this week to learn more about next steps. She said the collaboration with the Corps is critical for the future of flood fighting. In Juneau, I'm Clarice Larson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a veteran team wins this year's Iron Dog snow machine race.
It's going to have a lot of stories that go with it, but it feels good to be here, and it feels good to be here first.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news on Alaska News Nightly or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency has extended the deadline for people affected by the October 2025 West Coast storms to apply for individual assistance. The deadline is now April 3rd. It applies to individual assistance applications through FEMA, the state, and for federal Small Business Administration loans. This is the second extension of a deadline, initially set for December 2025, that would have expired last Friday. FEMA says it has so far approved $36 million in federal individual assistance for 2,084 households. Federal disaster assistance provides up to $42,500 for home repairs and up to $42,500 for other items. State assistance can cover certain things not covered by federal assistance, including subsistence camps. To apply for individual assistance before the April 3rd deadline, visit disasterassistance.gov or call the FEMA Alaska Call Center Apply for state assistance at ready.alaska.gov. Three Kotzebue residents are heading out on a month-long backcountry journey through rural Alaska, traveling mostly by snow machine. They're on a mission to educate small communities in western Alaska about the importance of voting. KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports.
Thank you, Jesus. We expect to hear a good report. And your engines,
wind and snow whip the Kotzebue preacher and the three travelers he's holding hands with in a circle.
Amen. Thank the Lord.
Weather wasn't part of that send-off prayer on February 12th. Initially, the group planned to travel over 600 miles to dozens of remote villages across western Alaska by snow machine. But back-to-back snowstorms in the regions, along with some mechanical issues, caused the group to reassess about 80 miles in and return to Kotzebue. Now the group plans to fly from Kotzebue to Amonik, then pick up snow machines and travel to several villages. Acha Kamarov says the initial hiccup didn't stop them because they are on a mission.
Our peoples need to be heard in by their voices, and one of the voices that we have as people in rural Alaska or any place is by voting.
Voter participation in rural Alaska is down from historic highs decades ago. In 1982, for example, state election data shows that more than 80% of registered voters in the Northwest Arctic participated. In the last presidential election, a little over 30% did.
We need to dubuk. That means wake it up and really look at what's going on so that we can make an impact by voting.
Kamarov says the group plans to give presentations in local schools to help educate high school seniors and community members about the issues, who is on the ballot, and how to register to vote. The trip is funded in part by Get Out the Native Vote and the Rural Mobilization Center, which are nonpartisan. The communities they plan to visit, around the Lower Yukon village of Amonik and around the Northwest Arctic, are not connected by any roads. Visitors usually arrive by small plane. But by traveling by snow machine, Kamarov says it's easier to connect.
I say go back door, you know, go into the village's back door or the way to go into the villages, you know, because it's so important to be at the level of our peoples, no matter where they are. And in the villages, we'll be at their level and our level.
They also enjoy being out in the country. Kamarov says the group plans to give their first presentations on voter education in Amonik. They'll head inland, visiting villages as far up the Yukon River as Pilot Station, then down to Nunum Iqua before heading back to Kotzebue. Then they plan to visit all 10 of the Northwest Arctic villages. The group is also packing emergency equipment, GPS, and paper maps, minus 40-degree sleeping bags, extra clothing, gas cans, spark plugs, and other snow machine parts. Although the trip is focused on voter education and advocacy, Kamarov says there's another goal, healing and processing grief. Arthur Richard Sr. is part of the group. He lost his wife and the mother of his four children to cancer this fall. He says it's been difficult for him, but things are getting better. He's looking forward to the trip.
And it's for me to be out there in the country where I love to be and get my mind clear. And
Raymond Brown Jr. is traveling with Richards and Kamarov. His brother Elmer Brown died in November after falling through thin ice near Kotzebue. Brown also thinks the trip will give him perspective.
My brother's lost, and my family, it's really going to just give me fresh air. It's going to be awesome.
The group plans to arrive in Amonik as early as Friday, and from there travel to half a dozen Lower Yukon villages before heading back to the Northwest Arctic. Kamarov says she will give updates on the group's travels on social media. In Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
The Ketchikan City Council updated municipal law last week to limit where people can sit, lay, or camp within city limits. They went into effect today, While some council members say the changes were created with safety in mind, several community members argue they could negatively impact the city's unhoused population. KRBD's Hunter Morrison reports.
The city council listened to roughly an hour of public testimony from about half a dozen people speaking against the proposals. Their message was similar. They believe the new laws could affect unhoused people.
At some point, we have to ask, what outcome are we trying to achieve?
That's Ryan McHale. In his testimony, he highlighted the need for solutions rather than regulations.
Enforcement without alternatives does not end homelessness.
According to the city manager's office, the ordinances were to, quote, address health, safety, and economic prosperity within the city. One new change to the municipal code deals with trespassing on city property. It also outlines new procedures related to issuing trespass warnings, including how an individual may appeal such warnings. The second adds a new chapter to the code, indicating that no person shall sit or lie down upon a public pedestrian way or other area, with some exceptions. Another code update makes it illegal to camp or use camping supplies on city-owned or leased property. Councilmember Riley Gass voted in favor of all three. He says over the last few years, he's noticed more people lying out on Ketchikan's public sidewalks and is concerned about people with mobility issues.
And I think this would be something that the police would use discretion on and only when people are refusing to clear the walkways for what they were designed for, which was people to travel on, not people to sprawl out across.
Councilmember Jay Matani also voted in favor of all three updates. He said they're meant to address a small group of bad actors, and that law enforcement officers are very, very compassionate when helping unhoused people. He says the issue will not go away overnight.
This particular ordinance, all three of them, were debated for about 2 years. It's not for lack of compassion. It is not to support a particular community, but it is for the whole community as a whole.
Not all council members supported the ordinances. Council members Jana Lee Gage and Jack Finnegan voted against two of the three pertaining to sitting or lying on walkways and camping on city property. Gage spoke at the meeting about wages not keeping pace with the cost of living and the need for more affordable housing, among other things. She said the city could be contributing to the issue of homelessness by, quote, the rates we're charging our community members. Finnegan reiterated the testimony of a community member, saying it's a balancing act weighing the need of ratepayers, business owners, and the community.
Ordinance changes like these, they do run the risk of criminalizing those most vulnerable members of our society, and they will not address the root causes of the situation that these people, these neighbors of ours, these community members of ours, find themselves in.
A few residents testified about how the law changes may lead to fewer options for the community's unhoused population. Both community and council members also highlighted the work that's currently being done in Ketchikan to address homelessness, like the Ketchikan Indian Community's temporary warming shelter. They spoke about the need for improved partnerships to address homelessness. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Hunter Morrison.
The Coast Guard commissioned its newest vessel in Kodiak earlier this month. The fast response cutter Frederick Mann is the sixth of its kind based in Alaska. Rear Admiral Bob Little, the commander of the Coast Guard in Alaska, says he's advocating for an increased presence in Alaska's Arctic.
So my objective and my direction, my team is push forward, push into the Arctic, find places to operate out of, test the system, identify capabilities that we need.
In January, Senator Dan Sullivan highlighted last year's One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which included nearly $25 billion for the Coast Guard. The Republican senator said that's the single largest cash investment the military branch has ever seen. Sullivan says more than $200 million have gone towards adding three fast response cutters for Coast Guard base Kodiak, which is the largest in the country. He says the six current cutters will be spread across coastal Alaska and joined by other Coast Guard vessels in the future.
And to spread it out, to make sure that it wasn't just Kodiak and Ketchikan, but fast response cutters to Sitka, to Seward, 87-footers to Juneau, to Petersburg, and then we later got one to Valdez.
Three fast response cutters currently dock in Kodiak, but one is slated to be home ported in Seward after $50 million of new infrastructure is in place there. Likewise, Ketchikan has two fast response cutters of its own, the John McCormick and Bailey Barco. A third is temporarily docking there until facilities in Sitka are ready.
As we build out our shipbuilding and ship maintenance capacity, which is clearly happening in Seward and Ketchikan and other places, because we're getting more ships, the Coast Guard's interest in putting even more ships in Alaska increases.
Sullivan is also pushing for some of the yet-to-be-built medium icebreakers to be homeported in Alaska as well. Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Kevin Lundy hasn't committed to where the 11 Arctic security cutters will be homeported, but he said during a Senate Commerce Subcommittee hearing last month that four of the vessels could go to Alaska. Well, the Pratt Museum in Homer is updating its research library to add digital tools and make room for new materials. As KBBI's Simon Lopez reports, a grant from the Homer Foundation is helping pay for the project.
For decades, the Pratt Museum has maintained a research library for students and researchers to study the museum's focus, Kachemak Bay culture, science, and art. It includes books and historical archives collected since opening in 1968. But Executive Director Whitney Harness says it's also got more than 500 outdated books on the niche subjects of fundraising and museum administration cluttering the shelves.
We don't really need to keep many of those. That is one of the biggest areas that we're trying to streamline our resources and make room for new resources.
That way, she says, resources in the library can focus on providing hyperlocal information and community history.
You know, we want to make sure that we're documenting and preserving community history, which helps to foster community identity.
The project costs $7,500. The Homer Foundation awarded the museum a $5,000 grant to help cover staff time to develop a collections policy for intentionally acquiring and removing library materials in line with the museum's mission. Harness says community members often donate items like old yearbooks and photographs. While those materials may not fit the museum's permanent collection, they can still support research and expand the community archive. She says the library serves longtime residents and newcomers.
Especially as we have more families moving into the area who are curious about the history of Homer. And then also on the flip side, we have a lot of longtime families who are either having the younger generation move out of state or passing on and losing some of those memories.
The project also includes adding a computer workstation and upgrading a projector so groups can view digital materials together. The museum will sell the books it's retiring from its collection during a community fundraiser in May. Staff will reintroduce the library during an open house at the end of March. In Homer, I'm Simon Lopez.
The Iron Dog Snow Machine race wrapped up in Fairbanks last weekend with a veteran team making race history. KNOM's Ben Townsend reports.
We got our first team in, number 7, Tyler Ackleston and Nick Olstead.
Coincidentally, this is also Nick Olstead's 7th Iron Dog win. Only two other riders have ever won that many times. And it's win number 5 for Tyler Ackleston. Together, they're now the most successful pairing in race history. No other team has won 4 times.
It's going to have a lot of stories that go with it, but it feels good to be here, and it feels good to be here first.
The 40-year-old says all the years he didn't make the podium made this possible. Like Olstead, he's been running the Iron Dog since the 2000s.
You have to be a strong rider. You have to be smart. You have to know how to run Iron Dog. Like, those are, when you talk about being a veteran and us running it 20-plus years, there's things that you learn far beyond just the trail things. It's how to run the race.
Olstad's first win came back in 2005 when he was a rookie. He's competed in every Iron Dog since, except for last year when a last-minute back injury took him out of the race. He says rigorous rehab and working out 5 days a week with his teammate got his 43-year-old body back in shape. And despite also rupturing his Achilles tendon last fall, Olstead says he went into the race feeling good.
I don't know, some of the jerseys, like even this year, you just have a feeling before the race. Like every year that me and Tyler won, I've had a feeling that we're going to win. And I tell him that, like, we're going to win.
This year's Iron Dog took teams from the start line in Big Lake, northwest to Kotzebue, then down to Nome for a one-day layover before heading east to Fairbanks for the finish. That's just over 2,300 miles. The defining factor of the race was a major Bering Sea storm that dumped over a foot of snow in some areas along the trail. Teams riding their speedy, short-track snow machines struggled along the Norden Sound. Iron Dog rider Stefan Booth says shifting shore-fast ice near Elim forced teams to take an overland trail rather than across the ice for safety.
It's a little portage trail. It wasn't broken in, and the snow on the trail was a little bit up to your waist, a little bit higher. You get off the trail, you probably go up to your neck.
While some teams fought to break trail on the clock, Olstad and Ackelstad backed off.
And then we started looking at the tracker. I'm like, they ain't even moving. And I'm like, man, they're only going like 1.4 miles an hour. And I'm like, figuring, I'm like, looking and see how much time they got 4 miles to go. I'm like, that's 4 hours or more. Probably the last time we'll just take all of our layover here and just be safe.
That paused the clock on their course time, and by the time they reached Nome, they had leapfrogged the former frontrunners who were part of the group stuck on the trail. They had a relatively clean run from Nome to the finish line in Fairbanks, busting just one windshield but avoiding major mechanical issues. Olstad says stay tuned for next year, when he'll go for a record-breaking 8th Iron Dog win.
I'd like to give it one more year, one more good, solid, hard year, try really hard, and then depending on how that went, you know, probably hanging up. It's time, you know, it's been a long time.
It is that time. We are going to give some trophies out here.
The top three teams line up in front of their snow machines and spray bottles of champagne into the crisp sub-zero air. 1 year from now, Olstad and Ackelstad hope to be back here with even more history to their names. Reporting from Fairbanks and Nome, I'm Ben Townsend.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Eric Stone and Clarice Larson in Juneau, Evan Erickson in Bethel, Desiree Hagen in Kotzebue, Hunter Morrison in Ketchikan, Davis Hovey in Kodiak, Simon Lopez in Homer, and Ben Townsend in Fairbanks and Nome. Our audio engineer tonight is Dave Waldron, Kirsten Dobroth is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.